I'm Russ White for MSU Today, and Lisa Dietlin is the founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. That's transformational, not transactional philanthropy. She's a Michigan native, an alumna of Michigan State University, and an internationally recognized expert on philanthropy, charitable giving, and transformational change. Lisa, welcome home and welcome to the show.
Oh, so happy to be back on the Spartan campus again.
So, Lisa, we're speaking at the 2017 Big Ten Development Conference, the people that raise funds for the universities to maintain their excellence. But let's start with, what even is philanthropy?
You know, to me, Russ, philanthropy is a grown-up word for sharing. It's just about giving up your resources, be it time, talent, or treasure, to make the world a better place.
And what about the transformational part? Explain that distinction.
Well, transformational means you're looking to give without expecting anything in return. You know, a lot of people, when they think about fundraising, think about, you know, buying a ticket to an event so you get to go to the event. Or they think about, you know, sponsoring something and you get a coffee mug. Or who needs another tote bag, I say. But really it's about, you know, you're giving of your heart substance or financially, and you're expecting nothing in return other than to do good in the world.
So these Big Ten fundraisers you were speaking with today, what sort of challenges and opportunities in fundraising do they face, as you say on your website, to do philanthropy better?
Well, I think the challenges they face is the proliferation of nonprofit organizations. You know, they say, according to the IRS, 100 new nonprofits apply every single day. So you think about that. There's 1.6 million nonprofits registered in the United States. So I think alma maters, you know, of different students and alumni have a challenge weeding that out. Now, the good news is, I think most people, when they think about giving, think about their house of worship, think about their alma mater, and then probably their kids' school. But it's staying front and center with those alumni and with those, you know, current students, to teach them that act of giving back. I think that's their biggest challenge.
Are there some key messages you hope you left with them today?
Well, I absolutely do. I think, first of all, I hope that, you know, they go back with a message of transformational philanthropy, not transactional. Like, let's not be worried about keychains and bumper stickers and, you know, tote bags. And that's the first message. I think the second is to realize that the untapped group of people, the overlooked potential donors, are entrepreneurs. Most people go to the major corporations or those really high-profile wealthy individuals or the high-profile civic families that we all have in our communities, the wealthy family that always gives. But they forget about that entrepreneur, that person who owns 3 McDonald's in your town, that person who has the asphalt company, that person who maybe makes something, manufactures something in your community that is transformative. I was in Canada last week, and the wind farms, you know, there are a lot of wind farms in Ontario, and I'm thinking, like, who makes those wind blades and who assembles that? Has anybody asked them for money? I mean, there's got to be an entrepreneur behind those.
I like how your mind is always going, talking with Lisa Dietlin on MSU Today. And Lisa, how do you inspire people then to make a difference by giving?
Well, you know, as I shared with the group today, my mom always asks me, how can I beg people every single day for money? And I tell her I don't. I give them the opportunity to change the world. And I think it's by painting a picture. You know, for me, it's about cleaning up a river. It's about putting books on a library shelf. It's about providing a meal for a senior that might not have a meal accessible to him or her because they paid for their medicine. Whatever that is, you know, I think about telling people a story of how they can actually make a difference. Now, if somebody says, you know, I don't care about rivers, I don't care about the environment, I don't care about libraries, I'm a tech person, I don't care about seniors, I care about kids, or I care about animals, then I think about finding something that they're passionate about. You can't put a square peg in a round hole. If somebody cares about animals, they're not going to care about cleaning up a river, most likely. So speak to their heart. The number one skill of a fundraiser that most people don't know, Russ, is listening.
I remember a journalist friend of mine used to say, we have 2 ears and 1 mouth, but run for a reason. Listen twice as much as you talk. But what would you say is the future of philanthropy then? And maybe how can technology accelerate it?
Well, the future of philanthropy is bright. What most people don't realize is that there are 12 million people that work in this field. That's 10.6% of the workforce. Or another way to look at it is the third largest employment sector in our country after retail and manufacturing. So think about it. There are more people that work in the nonprofit sector than work in oil and gas, than work in the automotive industry, or that work in technology. Every position that exists in the for-profit sector exists in the nonprofit sector. So if you're a janitor in the for-profit sector, you can be a janitor in the nonprofit sector. If you're an accountant in the for-profit sector, you can be an accountant in the nonprofit sector. If you are, you know, a nurse in the for-profit sector, you can be a nurse or a doctor in the nonprofit sector, or a teacher. Everything exists. Every position exists. We just don't think about this sector. Nobody grows up and says, Mom and Dad, I'm going to work for a charity when I get older. Yet, 12 million of us do.
You're the author of four books on the subjects of charitable giving and enacting positive change. Your fifth book is called The Power of Three, How to Achieve Your Goals by Simply Doing Three Things a Day. Tell me about that.
Well, this book came out of my fundraising days when a boss of mine gave me a big list and said, you know, call the list. And I argued with him because there were 500 names on the list. And I thought, how in the world could I call 500 people? But I realized if I called three people each day, Monday through Friday, that would be 15 a week, 60 a month, and 780 a year. That it would have actually exceeded his goal by 50%. So that's what I started doing. And you know, I think with any goal, that's the way you break it down. When I quit a job when I moved to Chicago and was unemployed, my family thought I was crazy. I had a place in Michigan. I had a place in Chicago. I said, don't worry, I'm going to get a job. And every day I did three things to find a job. Three things before I could take a walk on the lakefront, before I could go to the library and check out a book. You do a lot of free things when you're unemployed. Or take a nap. I had to do three things to find a job. Well, in 20 business days, I had 22 interviews, and 28 days after I left my job, I had a job. So it's that old adage, how do you eat an elephant? A bite at a time, breaking it down. And I think most people, when they have a goal, whether it's a New Year's resolution, you know, whether you want to lose weight, gain weight, get married, get divorced, buy a house, you know, move, change jobs, most people tend to do it all on the first day or the second day, and then, like, they give up by the third day.
Lisa, your sixth and most recent book is I Got Hit by a Taxi, But You Look Run Over, Life Lessons About Happiness and Joy. Explain that title, and how can focusing on happiness and joy help the fundraisers and the donors achieve their goals?
Well, it's based on a true life story. In 2014, I actually did get hit and run over by a taxi in the Loop of Chicago. And thankfully, even though he drove over me twice after I fell off the hood of the car, frontwards and backwards, I survived and survived without a scratch. But it was an awakening. It was an awakening because I had realized for quite a while that I was unhappy in my life with what I was doing, that while it looked really good on the outside, there were still some things I wanted to do. So I made some shifts and changes and decided to focus on those things that brought me happiness and joy. What did I like to do? And, you know, things that I like to do led me to interactions with people that did similar things that led to contracts and speaking engagements and all the building blocks for a life of success. It's when you are really doing what you love, that old adage, it's amazing what can happen to you. For me, it was about saying, you know what, I don't like managing people. I had a big company. I had 16 people I was managing. I did not like managing. I wanted to be a leader. And so what did I have to do? And as painful as it was to close a company and to let people go or help them find other jobs, I knew I couldn't keep living for them, that I couldn't keep living to make sure, because I knew their stories. I knew that if I closed the company and they didn't have that paycheck, what would happen to them? You know, where would they go? I was like trying to be mama bear, take care of everybody. And then I realized, but I need to focus on what makes me happy and what fills me with joy. And so, you know, when I started my company, one of the things I wanted to do was not work on Monday mornings and not work on Friday afternoons. And yet I found myself in a situation where I was working, you know, 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and every Monday and every Friday and every Saturday and Sunday. And I stopped that. And when I pulled back from that company, as painful as it was to start, and started saying, you know what, I'm not going to work Monday mornings. And I don't set an alarm anymore. I wake up when I wake up. I don't set an alarm anymore. And when I, you know, finish in the afternoon, I finish in the afternoon. It could be 3 or 4 o'clock. It could be 1 o'clock. I take a nap every day. I take a little shavasana, you know, a little yoga nap. I don't go out for 3 hours, people. But I do the things that bring me joy. For me, sitting, taking my nap, I lay down in my office. You know, I don't go get comfy on the bed or something. You know, I lay down in my office and I just close my eyes. And it's like I'm shutting off my computer to let it reboot. And it's amazing the wonderful ideas and thoughts and creativity that comes to me just by shutting down the brain for, you know, 20 minutes. And it's led me to live a life filled with happiness and joy. And if I'm a lot happier, the people around me are happier. If you have a positive attitude, people want to be around positivity. You know, when I listen to the news, I get so frustrated. I shouldn't say the news. I get frustrated with the news. But the weather people, when they go, there's a 30% chance of rain today. I go, there's a 70% chance of sunshine, people. Why aren't we saying there's a 70% chance of sunshine? You know, instead we're saying there's a 30% chance of rain. I was like, oh God, I better bring the umbrella. You know, it's the way you look at life. And I was blessed to be hit and run over by a taxi. I say that was a true blessing. And to not be injured, to escape without a broken bone, without a scratch, without even a bruise. There was no concussion. There was nothing. It's now been almost 3 years, and I have the best life imaginable.
And Lisa, I mentioned in my introduction that you are an MSU alumna. Tell me a little bit about how MSU impacted you and maybe still does.
Oh, I love Michigan State University. You know, it was the foundation of my building blocks of my career. I can trace, you know, my first jobs and my first career decisions back to being here at Michigan State University. I am lucky that I was one of those first generations, the first one in my family to go to college. My brother followed here. My sister-in-law, my niece is here. I just had dinner with her last night. She's in the zoology program and finishing up. So we bleed green and green and white and love it. But Michigan State University taught me that anything's possible. They taught me that they're a family, and sometimes you don't see your relatives all the time, but it's always good to come back home and be embraced by those that you love. So go green.
Go white. And Lisa, speaking of MSU students, you kind of quipped and were half serious too in your presentation today at the Big Ten Development Conference that kids don't grow up saying, Mom and Dad, I want to be a development officer. But how do we encourage more young people to get into this field you're so passionate about, and your advice for them, I guess?
Well, my advice for any young person is to follow their dreams and their passion. And as I shared, you know, every position that exists in the for-profit sector exists in the nonprofit sector. So if you're an engineer, you could be an engineer at a major educational institution. You think Michigan State, we're sitting here. They have engineers. They have engineers on staff. They have people that take care of the buildings, you know, that build the buildings, that, you know, make sure the HVAC system's working or the heat's working or what have you. I think it's about opening up their eyes. When we think about that this sector is so large and it, you know, is third only to retail and manufacturing, you know, we have to start talking about it. It is coming into its own. You can start to get some bachelor's degrees in the field. There's a plethora of master's degree programs and a few PhD programs. The research there, we're talking about it more and more. People are writing books, appearing on television and radio programs, talking about it. I think the misnomer that if you work in this field, you won't get paid, you won't have health benefits, you won't get vacation days, is a misnomer. You know, we have to educate people that this is a robust career field. Yes, you're not going to get those stock options, you know, as if you were working at a major, you know, Fortune 100, Fortune 500 company. Yes, you are not going to get bonuses as if you were at a law firm or whatever. But what you do get is at the end of the day, you know you've changed someone's life. You know you've changed the trajectory of something that's going on. You know, today I just heard that the iceberg, you know, I think it's Lawson Sea, you know, broke off in Delaware, the size of Delaware. It's the size of the state of Delaware. And I'm thinking somebody somewhere is sitting in a research lab of a nonprofit organization figuring out how that's going to impact the world and how what's left of that ice shelf is going to impact the world. And what their research is doing is going to help the future of humanity. And if that's not a reason to work in the nonprofit sector, what is? I mean, it is about feeding hungry kids. It is about making sure seniors are taken care of. It is making sure that rivers are cleaned up and that books are put on library shelves and that all the animals are taken care of and spayed and neutered or whatever you believe in. You know, that is what you get to do in the nonprofit sector. And when you put your head on the pillow at night, you can close your eyes and say, you know, I made a difference today.
Lisa, your passion is contagious. Thank you for talking with us about transformational philanthropy and happiness today.
Thank you for letting me be here and share a little bit about my grown-up word for sharing.
That's Lisa Dietland. She's the founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. She's a Michigan native and an MSU alumna. And you can find out more about Lisa and read all her great books at lisadietland.com. That's L-I-S-A. Dietlin, LisaDietlin.com. And I'm Russ White for MSU Today.